People First Radio is a program about people, the society in which we live, and issues related to health and wellness.
Welcome to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. Researcher Cole Kennedy says if you've seen one brain injury, you've seen one brain injury. Kennedy is the lead author on new research from the University of Victoria, published just in time for Brain Injury Awareness Month this June. It was focused on improving health services for people with brain injuries, experiencing homelessness, and mental health and substance use issues. Kennedy says that it's well known by the public that a high proportion of people experiencing homelessness have a mental health and substance use disorder. He says that not as visible is a hidden brain injury epidemic. On today's program, we're going to be exploring Kennedy's research and brain injury more broadly. We'll also hear from people sharing firsthand connections to brain injury.
Hello, my name is Cole Kennedy. I'm a PhD student in clinical neuropsychology at the University of Victoria. I'm a member of the Cortex Lab in the Department of Psychology. I'm an affiliate with the Institute on Aging and Lifelong Health, as well as the Canadian Institute on Substance Use Research. And all of my research is really at the intersections of brain injury, mental health, and addictions. And I'm very excited to be sharing and speaking about a recent study that we published on the topic as it pertains to housing and homelessness.
Yes, you were the lead author on that study that came out just in time for Brain Injury Awareness Month this year. What was the goal? What were you researching?
The main goal of that study was to partner with people with lived experience, with community stakeholders, including family members, including physicians and other service providers, to help identify community-driven strategies, so strategies that works for the people who need it the most, on healthcare service delivery catered towards people experiencing brain injury, mental health, addictions, and homelessness. So a very marginalized and underserved group, but still a very significant part of our population that not a lot of knowledge is on. So we wanted to partner with them and understand what their priorities are for healthcare service delivery, but as well as healthcare service research and how researchers can improve the state of knowledge on those intersections.
And we will get to today what came out of your research, what people identified as the priorities. Maybe before we do, is there any important context you feel people should know about maybe the prevalence of things like brain injury, mental health disorders, and substance use disorders among populations experiencing homelessness?
The prevalence of mental health and substance use disorders is very high amongst people experiencing homelessness. Broadly, approximately 68% of people who experience homelessness have a mental health or substance use disorder. So that could be depression, anxiety, PTSD, drug and alcohol use disorders. And this is fairly commonly known. I think it's more obvious to the public. We see it on our streets. In Canada, this estimate is even higher. Approximately 76% of the estimated 235,000 people experiencing homelessness have a mental health and substance use disorder. So I think that piece is, like I said, fairly well known because it's more visible to the general public. But what's not as visible is the hidden brain injury epidemic that is being experienced by people who are unhoused. There's a wealth of evidence to show, and in particular, meta-analytical evidence shows that over 50% of people who are experiencing homelessness have a history of a TBI or a traumatic brain injury. So these are injuries to our brain caused by an external force. This could be a car accident, it could be a fall, it could be through violent attacks. And this was not as commonly recognized among researchers, among the healthcare service delivery, and among the healthcare service system in general. Another piece of that too, I might add, is we're not just talking about traumatic brain injury amongst people who are experiencing homelessness. We're also talking about traumatic brain injury that's sustained through opioid, primarily opioid overdoses, and toxic drug poisoning events. These injuries, far less is even known about them as opposed to traumatic brain injury. We don't have statistics on them. We know that people experiencing homelessness have higher rates of fatal overdoses, so we can suspect that the rate of non-fatal overdose is also high in this group, and that from there we can infer that the rate of non-fatal opioid overdose-induced hypoxic ischemic brain injuries is especially high. So I like to add that piece as well. We're not just talking about traumatic brain injuries. This isn't just falls. This isn't just motor vehicle accidents. This is also a large population of people who are experiencing brain injuries due to overdose, many of which may not be aware of their brain injuries, many of which are currently being underserved by our healthcare system.
And what do we need to know about those brain injuries as far as like what their impact is likely to be on people?
In terms of brain injury broadly, so traumatic and non-traumatic brain injuries, there's much we need to know. We know that every brain injury is different. So the cookie cutter approach doesn't work in terms of treatment as well as in terms of diagnosis. Amongst people experiencing homelessness, where we know there's lots of different current health conditions going on, as well as mental health and substance use conditions, it can be difficult to tease apart what symptoms are from a brain injury and what symptoms are from mental health or substance use. So the tools we use as healthcare providers are not well attuned to teasing those pieces apart and understanding whether someone may have had a brain injury because symptoms like fatigue and headache and irritability may be symptoms of a mental health disorder. They may be symptoms of withdrawal or signs of intoxication from a substance, or they could be due to a brain injury. So one of the big priorities for researchers and for healthcare providers is figuring out how do we best recognize brain injury in this population, and how do we differentiate it between mental health and substance use disorders?
Do you have any answers to those questions?
Much of my training thus far is in psychometrics. I'm a neuropsychology PhD student, so we get trained in testing and psychological and neuropsychological assessment. So I understand the complexities behind this and teasing those symptoms apart. I wish I had the golden ticket, but I think we need to start by partnering with community to find out what's working and what's not. There hasn't been a lot of research in terms of developing tools that are sensitive to people with brain injuries who also use substances. It's often in research an exclusionary criteria. So if we're trying to understand the symptomatology of a brain injury, its impact on someone, and how to best detect it, we need to not be as restrictive in our research criteria and allow people to participate in our studies that come with a broad range of abilities and difficulties and diagnoses to help create solutions, and particularly diagnostic solutions that are representative to what the problem looks like in the real world.
And this brings us back to the research you introduced off the top, where you were working with communities of people who had experienced brain injuries, who had experience with mental health and substance use disorders, and experience with homelessness, to check in on what they felt could be solutions. And your paper suggested that, as far as you know, this was some of the very first research of this kind ever to get published.
There are many studies that give recommendations on how to create change. There are many studies that look at identifying the burden of a problem and then quantifying that burden. So this study was different because we went right to the people who are engaging with these issues on a daily basis. So people with lived experience, community support workers, first responders, we brought them all together. And we really used a bottom-up approach, and we said, what should we do and in what order? What is most important? So we started by just opening the dialogue, but then also systematically collecting that information and building those recommendations in an actionable way. One of the big things I think that sets this study apart is its participatory action approach. So engaging participants and people with all this rich knowledge through their experiences to help create these solutions together. We're really giving them a platform and a way to articulate their wants and needs and opinions and their potential solutions that they think would be effective and equitable, rather than us coming in and setting our own agenda. So that's one of the big ways in which this study differs from previous research. Another way this study differs from previous research is its intersectional approach. So there's lots of recommendations on how to address mental health and substance use in people experiencing homelessness. Lots of recommendations, well, less recommendations for brain injuries, certainly, but that they're out there. Not a lot for the two together in this population. And that's really came out of a recognition that the burden of brain injury and the burden of mental health and substance use disorders and their co-occurrence is so high amongst people experiencing homelessness that we can't tackle these issues separately. We need to tackle it together through an intersectional lens.
What is maybe the consequence of that if I'm someone who maybe yesterday I had these perceptions about people experiencing homelessness that didn't include an understanding of brain injury as part of the equation? Now, let's say today I hear you saying this and I say, oh, now I understand that a big part of this equation is brain injury. What does that change? How is my understanding different?
One of the largest takeaways, I hope that by fostering public awareness for the rate of brain injury amongst people experiencing homelessness, one of the pieces that we really hope to do is to promote some greater compassion. I think compassion and understanding can be low in some communities for people experiencing homelessness. And I think there is some people hold a perception that, people who are living on the streets are there by their own choice and they choose to do this. And by bringing the shining a light on the brain injury piece, my hope is that we can help build compassion and understanding for if someone has a brain injury and they lose their job, they experience changes in their relationships, can lead to family breakdown. A lot of those roads lead to homelessness. So it's not a personal choice for many. When we add the brain injury equation, they are living with lifelong conditions, many of which are left untreated and are not well supported by our system. There is another potential consequence as well that's important to note when we talk about raising awareness for brain injury and its impacts on people, and particularly people who are unhoused. While brain injuries can cause a wide range of different cognitive deficits, so that can be in memory, in attention, in executive functioning, sometimes in self-awareness, the vast majority of people who have a brain injury are still able to make their own decisions, including on their healthcare. So just because someone has cognitive impairments doesn't mean they're incapable of making their own decisions. And I think it's important to differentiate between those two aspects of a brain injury, especially in a group who experiences such high rates of stigmatization.
You're listening to People First Radio. Cole Kennedy's work lies at the intersection of brain injury, mental health, and addictions. He's a PhD student in clinical neuropsychology at the University of Victoria. He's also the lead author on new research that brought together people with experience of brain injuries, homelessness, and mental health and substance use disorders. Its goal was to get perspectives on how to improve healthcare services, keeping brain injuries in mind. We'll hear more from Kennedy later on in the show. June is Brain Injury Awareness Month. Last year, to mark the occasion, we put together a two-episode focus on the subject. We heard from Adele Rogers, who has worked with the Nanaimo Brain Injury Society. She shared some of her family's experiences with brain injury. Have a listen.
14 years ago, my son, who was 19 at the time, was in a car crash. and it resulted in a severe brain injury. And it was devastating, of course, for my son, but it was also devastating for the family. And at that time, and still now, when it comes to traumatic brain injury, there's little prognosis in terms of recovery and abilities as they are going through their recovery. So it can be a very scary and challenging place, not just for the individual, but the family members, because it basically, Joe, changes the trajectory for everyone at that point. And in our case in particular, because he was 19. So we had 6 months in the hospital and continued rehabilitation after that. So we became quite intimate with the various services that were provided, both in the hospital from the acute phase to the rehabilitation. And then, of course, the transition into the, you know, going back home, living in the community, trying to navigate life for my son and our family in a very different way.
Rogers spoke about transitioning back into the community after acute care following a brain injury. She also spoke about the impact peer support from other people who have experienced brain injuries can have on a person.
One of the most impactful pieces moving forward to give us hope was having visitors come. We had two individuals, actually, young men really close to my son's age who'd had significant injuries, acquired brain injury, and they were doing really well. And, you know, nothing could have provided that kind of hope like they did, right? And you had alluded to earlier that every injury is so different and so unique. And that's why, you know, rightfully so, the medical professionals, they can't really give you anything to hang on to cling to in terms of hope, because every recovery is so different. Every individual, where they were coming into their injury, the kind of support systems they have after. Do they have a good support team once they've left that hospital? Everything is very looked after while you're in the hospital, right? Acute care is amazing, right? And then once you leave the hospital, you're into the community. And what needs to take place for the individual is that ongoing care, that ongoing rehabilitation. And that's really tricky to nail down because, you know, the emphasis is on that acute care and making sure they survive their injuries, making sure they get off to a good start. And then the rest is up to the individual and the family members. So the transition back into community is really tricky.
Rogers says that brain injury is an invisible condition, and that can cause challenges for people when they try to access everyday services in the community.
We're trained to look for being under the influence of the people that we're serving. And unfortunately, for a lot of individuals with brain injury, many of their symptoms look like they're under the influence. And for them, it completely changes the dynamics of, you know, their social interactions. And it's primarily because brain injury is often considered the invisible injury. And so the expectations for somebody, for example, coming, you know, walking up to do their business at the bank, right? They look fine, but perhaps when they start to ask for their service, they're maybe slurring, they may be, you know, a little bit off balance. And then it instantly creates this dynamic because the person that's supposed to help them isn't quite sure of what they're working with. And I'm going to do a little plug here for the Nanaimo Brain Injury Society to say our clients have a brain injury ID card. It says what their symptoms are. And I can tell you, we get feedback all the time on how positively impactful those cards are. When they have to pull them out, it just totally changes the way they're treated. Unfortunately, it has to sometimes take that card. But the other thing is, a lot of clients will say just having that card, that, you know, if they have to pull it out, provides a lot of confidence for them, which is huge when you're trying to renavigate, you know, your social community and the context and whatnot. So it's really important for people to have something that they can show if they need to let other people know what their situation is. And so then there's more empathy, if you will.
Adele Rogers speaking with the program in 2024 about her family's experiences with brain injury.
This is People First Radio, coming to you on CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo, on CFMH Local 107.3 FM in St. John, and on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria.
June is Brain Injury Awareness Month. Cole Kennedy is the lead author on new research that spoke with people who have experience of brain injury, homelessness, and mental health and substance use disorders. The research asked impacted groups about their priorities or how to improve care. I spoke with Kennedy about that research and about brain injury more generally. Let's get you back to that conversation. So you spoke with people who have had experiences of homelessness, of brain injury, of mental health and substance use disorders. You were looking to find out what they think we should put more focus on in healthcare, what they think some of the solutions could be. What did you hear?
In terms of recommendations for clinical practice, unsurprisingly, one of the first things we heard was that the healthcare and social and housing systems need to provide accessible and affordable supportive housing. And this housing needs to be catered to the needs of people with brain injuries who may have mobility issues. They may have, many of them have are living off disability payments and things like that. So rental subsidies was a big piece that came up as well. We heard that resources need to be enhanced for service providers, and this is both in terms of financial resources, such as funding, but as well as human resources and training. So training on the intersections between brain injury, mental health, and addictions, and training on how to best address these pieces in people who are experiencing homelessness. We also heard a need to design needs-based services that promotes quality of life. So not just treating different conditions individually, treating them together, but also focusing on promoting quality of life and activities associated with quality of life. Another piece that we uncovered was this real need for improved communication and collaboration between service providers. There is a large recognition amongst people in our sample that service providers in our healthcare system in general, including our electronic medical records, don't communicate very well. And for people with brain injuries, this can be very burdensome to have to explain their injury again and again and again at different points of care. So there was a real recognition for a more collaborative approach, as well as an integrative approach that's long-term. So some continuity of care. Lastly, stigma came through as a very strong thing experienced by people with lived experience. And there was a recognition that there's a lot of stigma that's faced within this group. People experiencing homelessness face a great deal of stigma. People with mental health and substance use disorders face a great deal of stigma. Brain injury survivors face a great deal of stigma. When we put those together, that's a tremendous amount of stigma faced by sometimes it's members of the public. Sometimes it's when they go to access healthcare services. So we found from stakeholders in our sample that this stigma needs to be addressed. And their recommendation for that was to address it through different public health education campaigns and just promoting public awareness in general.
one of the things you talked about there was the idea that something that beneficial would be treatment or care that focuses on quality of life. And I'm wondering if you could give me a little more detail on what exactly that means and what that could look like.
In terms of treatment that promotes quality of life, it needs to address the whole person within their system. So within their family system, within other social systems and relationships around them. Often our healthcare system treats the symptom and not the cause as well. So if we can help understand that, for example, you know, brain injury can cause stress on families, and family stress may then perpetuate the symptoms of brain injury, like fatigue and irritability and emotional reactivity and symptoms of depression. So if we can support the whole system, including the family system, then we can actually do better for the person and their loved ones. So that's just one example of promoting quality of life. But also we need to build greater independence and support people in their quest for independence. So things like occupational therapy techniques, like teaching them how to cook, teaching them how, relearning how to go grocery shopping and interact with community in different ways. These are all aspects of quality of life that are not always addressed, especially for people who have undiagnosed brain injuries. So there's quite a bit of emphasis on improving that aspect through different interventions, many of which will need to involve a number of different healthcare providers as well.
You also talked about the idea of reducing stigma through public health education. What do you mean? What does that look like?
I think a big piece is just in promoting awareness that there are many people out there living with brain injuries and their conditions are not being treated. Most conditions don't just get better on their own, and brain injury is no exception. So the public needs to understand or try to understand that people who are experiencing homelessness with brain injuries and mental health and substance use disorders, they're not there by choice. Most of the time they're living with untreated health conditions that are really perpetuating their cycle of marginalization, of stigma. And if we can shine a light on that, we can start to build compassion. And in doing so, hopefully generate new investments, whether it be funding, into help solving this public health inequity.
Do you think that something that is happening right now in maybe what I'll call the public discourse, like, do you think we're trending in the right direction on that in the last year or so?
I think it's difficult because with growing awareness, different pieces come to light and there's the opportunity for things to be misconstrued. I think the public is starting to become more aware that brain injury is something that is affecting our unhoused community. But with that awareness, there is some kind of damaging rhetoric out there around violence and around random attacks. And we want to ensure that we're not further stigmatizing the brain injury community or the unhoused community.
And so what is the way to do that? To, like, if there are specific events or instances of random attacks, how can those kind of be addressed in the public discourse without kind of stigmatizing everyone who falls within a certain community, or without, you know, associating it with a specific community?
I think anytime there's negative events that occur, we can't look at a condition and make sweeping blanket statements on what that condition entails and how it affects people and how they're going to behave. Every brain injury is different. If you've seen one brain injury, you've seen one brain injury, right? So we need to take a step back and look about how to better support people as well, how to treat the root causes, and also look at prevention. If we can prevent people from falling into a cycle of repeated brain injuries through opioid overdoses or through violent attacks or through domestic violence, we can help protect their brains and protect them, their future possibility of engaging in any risky behaviors if that's something we're worried about. So I think at times the public can be quick to blame the person, but we also need to look at the system that may have ended them up there. And we also have to have a very strong recognition that those are very rare cases that result in violence or things like that. There are the vast majority of people living with brain injuries are not violent. They're just trying to recover from their injuries and rebuild their lives and live meaningful and purposeful lives.
Are there any other misconceptions you feel like are out there as regards brain injury or people experiencing homelessness or the intersection between them?
I think one of the largest misconceptions out there is around cognitive impairment after brain injury. So symptoms like difficulties with working memory, with executive function, so planning, organization, decision-making. These are often common outcomes of brain injury, but they don't mean that someone isn't capable of making their own decisions. So around capacity, you can have problems with memory, but you can still make your own decisions on your housing, on your healthcare, or on other aspects of your life. So it's the two are distinct kind of phenomena and outcome of brain injury. The lack of capacity and incapacity is only seen in very severe cases. It is not the majority of cases by any means. So I want to impress upon people that just because someone might have a difficult time remembering doesn't mean that they can't make their own decisions, or just because they might be a bit more impulsive or they have trouble organizing their materials or keeping track of their appointments, they're still fully capable of making their own decisions, including on their healthcare. They just may need a bit more support and time and space and resources to help them make decisions.
This is People First Radio. We're exploring brain injury on today's program. June is Brain Injury Awareness Month. We've been hearing from University of Victoria PhD student Cole Kennedy. He led research that gathered perspectives from people with experience of brain injury, homelessness, and mental health and substance use disorders. The data for that research was collected last year at an event called the BC Consensus on Brain Injury Project. It took place in Victoria. Lila Manson and Lance Point were there. They're outreach workers with Snoqualmie First Nation. Last summer, I was able to speak with them to get their perspectives on brain injury. Here is some of that conversation.
Good morning, I'm Lila Manson. I work for Snoqualmie as an outreach worker.
Good morning, this is Lance Point. I also am Snoqualmie, started work about a year ago and do the same work.
And the focus of the program today is brain injury. Can you tell me how you kind of came into this world?
Myself, I believe, has to do a lot with my past. I came in originally as a peer support worker. My experiences in drug addiction, treatment centers, detoxes, the whole world of addiction. So that's myself. I didn't realize how much brain injury affected me until I started working here, until I started meeting people that specialize in that. Today I realized that myself, I have experienced quite a bit of trauma with my brain injuries and stuff, and that's due to addictions and falling and having seizures and all of that.
For me, it was more of being involved in the CATS group, and it's the community action group that I was a part of, and the Brain Injury Society was a part of it, and learning all about that and how it really, drugs and alcohol affect the brain, and how I had to hit the ground running because I really don't have a background in social whatever work and stuff. So understanding where our clients come from and why they have these psychoses and why they can't do certain things that everyone else can do. So for me, it's just helping to understand our clients better.
Are there any big things you think maybe the general public isn't super aware of when it comes to brain injury?
I think mainly the thing is, like, with the people we deal with, there are clients. I know that 80% of them have brain injuries to deal with addictions on top of both. I think that dealing with them individually doesn't happen. So either you get, you know, looked at as an addict. So then you don't get to deal with the brain injury side on the side of it. So you don't get the help that they need. They'll get sent to treatment, detox and stuff, but then you won't get the mental side of it. So that's one of the things that I never myself as a client before, and now where I can see it today. Yeah, so that's it.
So there are maybe a lot of people when they're getting help, getting some kind of treatment for addiction, there's also a brain injury piece that's kind of not looked at, not realized, and not factored into the treatment?
Definitely. That's one of the things that I noticed with myself and with our clients. Like, they'll get looked at as addicts and need help in this area, but not be able to deal with the other side of it, right? And it's one of those things that we're missing out on. We're not dealing with all sides of the wheel, right?
So when you know that, or when we factor that in, how can things change? How does what treatment looks like change?
I think the best ways to deal with the treatments and detoxes is not just look at it as like the addiction part of it. The main thing is to deal with the spiritual side and the mental side on top of that.
Yeah, I feel that it needs to be more rounded and more open-end questions for clients, and not take it such a clinical route. Like, how we've connected with our clients is we ask where they're from, who their family is, and that's a teaching. That's something that we get taught growing up in the community, is that to help understand where someone comes from, you need to understand who they came from and where they come from. Because I've had clients that were hard to house, and I was like, do you understand this person probably went to day school, this person probably went to residential school, so they don't trust non-natives and they don't feel safe with non-natives because they were putting that non-safe environment in kids in care. Same thing as when I first started, it was 30% of my clientele were kids that were just that aged out, and they would tell you your story. As long as you're willing to listen to someone and let them be heard, I think that makes a huge difference, because that's how I felt when I went to treatment. I got heard and I got listened to, even though I got scolded for still being who I was. It was part of my process, right? We don't see people who have brain injuries as someone. We see them as a symptom of what they do or how they act out, and that's not okay, because I believe that everyone that is out there homeless has sort of some sort of trauma. We all have some sort of trauma. Like, no one's lives in a perfect bubble. If we all did, we'd all be the same, and that's still not okay either. But we're just doing what we're doing as the best we can. And brain injury, I feel, plays a big part now due to the drug overdoses.
You mentioned the idea that sometimes we don't see necessarily someone who's experienced, say, a brain injury. We don't see them as a person almost. We just kind of look at these symptoms. What can you tell me about how we can not do that and what it looks like to not do that?
I think we have to have a different approach to how we treat people. Like, a lot of our clientele will not go to the hospital, even if they're not well and they think that they can do their treatments without that. And I get it, and it's hard to go to the hospital if you're an addict, because where you're placed and how you're treated. Like, I have family members that are still in addiction, and it's like a struggle just to be there, and it's to have family sit there and the family is hopeless too, right? Because you can't make people get clean and sober or out of addiction because you love them. You have to be there for them when they're ready, because everyone's rock bottom is different, right? And it's just, addiction is a cruel game that I feel is a form of like a slow suicide, because you're numbing out. And for me, I just would say to family members and friends, to say, if you go to treatment, you don't go to treatment, don't have to go to treatment to quit using. You go to the treatment to figure out why you have to use, why you have to numb out. Like, we had a conversation with a client the other week, and the boyfriend was mad because his girlfriend was high. And I said, well, you need to go ask her why she got high, not about the person that gave her the drugs. Why does she need to numb out today? Is it an anniversary date? Is it something? Like, it's just, it needs to be looked at differently. And it's not just a one-stop shop either. Like, I've done the treatment route, I've done healing groups, I've done all this stuff for myself. So it's, and I like that there's different approaches lately about treatment. So it's, to start early is a good one. Like, we're going today to Orkalalem for their opening, and that's for youth. And that's a huge thing for a First Nations group to be opening that from Comet Laylam. So I'm just thankful that we're finally opening doors that need to be open.
Would you be willing to share maybe a bit about how some of your experiences in treatment, how those maybe inform the work you do now?
When I went to treatment, I was already clean and sober for 6 months. And my reality when I went to treatment was that I was the only one. And that was shocking, because they tell you that you have to 3 months to get there, and I get there, and it was just like, it's all about trusting the process and surrendering to whatever it is, right? We surrender every day to get up to go to work. We surrender every day to have a conversation with our child when they're having an outburst. We have to surrender when we're dealing with our partners and our families and our work. And I think understanding and remembering what your bottom is, for me, is what keeps me in recovery. And that's mainly how I survive daily. And it's not that I'm stronger or anything. I just have the willingness to try to do better than I did the day before.
I know you were both at this big conference in Victoria in June, all about brain injury. Would you be able to share with me maybe what the message was that you were bringing to that you were sharing with people at the conference?
I think the message that I wanted to bring there was the effects of the homelessness and addiction and brain injury all together as one, right? So one doesn't come without the other. Myself, I've spent many, many years out there in addiction, and I think that all of my associates out there have had overdoses and don't know how to get out of that cycle, right? Like, as soon as you get in the cycle, and it's so hard to find a plan to get out of it. Once you get involved in prisons or in probation, it took me a good couple decades to figure out how to get help, how to ask for help, how to see people that were trying to help me for who they were. So I think what I wanted to bring there is my own experiences and what I felt when I was homeless out there. That's why I was a part of it. I wanted them to know that, you know, a lot of people want help, but the help is in different ways, not there yet. Not in Nanaimo, not in, like, Victoria, I think, is a little bit ahead of us with that. But I'm here in Nanaimo. The shelters are not there. The OPSs are not there. And the living, there's not enough, right? So it's a big part of the homelessness. And the supports that go around brain injury with the help educated people around the help. Because I could get clean and sober today and still not be all there.
Lilo Manson and Lance Point are outreach workers with Snoqualmie First Nation. We were speaking last summer for a program on brain injury. The conference we were talking about informed newly published research from Cole Kennedy. He's a PhD student in clinical neuropsychology at the University of Victoria. We heard from him already earlier on in the program. His work lies at the intersection between brain injury, mental health, and addictions. Let's get you back to that conversation on People First Radio. I'm wondering if you can give me a bit of perspective on Canada's efforts towards a national strategy on brain injury.
A national strategy on brain injury is our number one kind of shining star ultimate goal. We've been advocating it for very many years, especially my good friend and colleague, Janelle Breeze-Biagioni. She has been the North Star for the brain injury community in BC and across Canada, and really at the helm of the national strategy movement. A national strategy will mandate the federal minister of health to act upon brain injury services and collect data to help us understand the true impacts of brain injury. It is very much needed. Right now, we live in and operate within a system that is very siloed, and a national strategy is a framework and a starting point, a launching off point to help break down those silos, to integrate our system, and to better serve people living at the intersections of brain injury, mental health, and substance use.
So what do we have to do to get there?
Well, if you ask Janelle, she would tell you you need to contact your MPs, your MLAs, your mayors, any people in any form of municipal, provincial, federal government to help push this movement forward. I was part of a delegation that visited Ottawa in 2022, I believe it was, and we met with a number of people there. There was all party support. Everyone was on board. Unfortunately, that was for Bill C-277, which fell through the cracks with the recent political shifts that have occurred in recent history. But we're very happy to announce that on June 10th, so just not too many days ago, Bill C-206 was introduced in the House of Commons. This is the reintroduction of the National Strategy on Brain Injury Act. This was introduced by Gord Johns, the MP for Courtney Alberni. So it's a very exciting development for the brain injury community, for us as researchers, and for everyone who wants to improve the state of care, knowledge, and research for brain injury in Canada.
We started off this conversation by talking about this research you just had published. It was asking people who had experience of brain injuries and homelessness about what they think are the priorities for healthcare research. What do you do with that now? What are the next steps?
Our findings and looking at the priorities of what community-based stakeholders need now, all of them support a national strategy. Many of the pieces, like enhancing resources, designing needs-based services that promote quality of life, improving communication and collaboration between service providers, these are all things that can happen with the right efforts through a national strategy. So this really underscores the need for a national strategy, but at the more local level, it also serves as a guide for healthcare providers. There are things that we uncovered in this study that may not come to mind for them. For example, people with brain injuries who are unhoused, they likely have a number of different medical appointments that they may need to attend. They may have difficulty remembering those appointments. And when they arrive at them, they might have nowhere to store their belongings. So there are basic needs that are different in this population than other people with brain injuries who are housed, or people with mental health and substance use disorders without brain injuries. So the overlapping conditions does create an environment of unique needs for them And we've really outlined some recommendations on how to address those needs at the individual level, so at the provider level, but also at the delivery and innovation level of healthcare services, how they can be designed to better serve people's needs. And also at the systemic level, for things like funding, for things like reducing stigma. So there are a number of actionable items that are contained within this study that we really hope the community will pick up on and help move the dial forward and create some meaningful change.
If I'm not a frontline healthcare worker or some kind of healthcare administrator or some kind of senior level politician, what do you think it's useful for me to know about this, about brain injury?
I think one thing everyone should know about brain injury is just how common it is. It's Brain Injury Awareness Month, so in an effort of promoting that awareness, we know that 1 in 3 Canadians is affected in some way by brain injury, whether it be themselves, whether it be a family member. And no brain injury is alike. So someone who experiences a brain injury, who's an elite athlete and they have a concussion and they get many supports after and maybe they're fully recovered in 2 weeks, is going to look a lot different than a woman who's experiencing violence at the hands of her intimate partner, who's sustaining multiple brain injuries behind closed doors. We also know that brain injuries are happening as a result of opioid overdose and other substance use related concerns. And these are going largely undetected. And by nature of being largely undetected, they're going largely untreated. So brain injury is everywhere. It's our neighbors, our teachers, our folks on the street, our family members and loved ones. It's affecting everyone, and often it's not always recognized. So if we can help shine a light on that piece, improve recognition, improve awareness, and improve compassion and understanding, I think we can really help improve the state of knowledge and the state of care for people living with brain injuries.
What are some of the big things we still don't know when it comes to brain injuries?
We know quite a bit about brain injuries in terms of their medical neuropathology and some of the symptoms that arise. I think one of the conversations that comes up a lot is neuroplasticity. And we know that the brain can bounce back, and with the right supports, people can relearn different abilities and help achieve their goals. So there's much that we don't know in that sense about how the brain recovers. It's a very resilient organ, but it's also a very sensitive one. So the brain is full of mysteries. But I think when it comes down to the practical sense of it, one of the pieces that we don't quite yet know how to best address is the diagnosis piece in the context of concurrent mental health and substance use concerns. It can be very difficult to tease those symptoms apart and to recognize what is the brain injury, what is due to a brain injury, and what is due to mental health, and what is due to substance intoxication and symptoms of substance use disorders. So we haven't yet created a tool that can help differentiate between those conditions and recognize people's conditions and connect them with the proper care.
You also talked about the idea of prevention as being super, super important when it comes to brain injuries. What does prevention look like?
Prevention can look like many different things. It depends on the type of injury. So for example, the seatbelt has been a breakthrough in preventing traumatic brain injuries, as has the helmet. But for, say, overdose-induced hypoxic ischemic brain injuries, we don't have a seatbelt. We don't have a helmet yet. So when we think about preventing brain injuries as a result of overdose, we can look to different strategies like harm reduction. If we can prevent an overdose from occurring through naloxone, through different supports like those offered by overdose prevention sites and supervised consumption sites, then we can prevent brain injuries from occurring. So prevention is really going to look different based on the type of injury that you are trying to prevent. Similarly, for brain injuries that are sustained as a result of intimate partner violence, which predominantly affects women, prevention can look like intervention for perpetrators of violence and connecting them with psychological supports like therapy and anger management, as well as substance use treatment, can really help lower rates of intimate partner violence and domestic violence. So prevention is really the best intervention, and it has to be targeted based on the type of injury that you're hoping to prevent, but it needs to be upstream and it needs to be at the root causes of brain injury.
Is there anything else you think it's important to bring to the conversation while it's Brain Injury Awareness Month in 2025?
I think it's critical that everyone get out and support Bill C-206, the National Strategy on Brain Injury Act. I think we really have a chance of creating a difference here. We've come so close in the past. We've had all party support in the House of Commons in the past. We really need to push this through. I think it has the potential to change the state of brain injury education, brain injury prevention, brain injury intervention, brain injury research, and of course, brain injury healthcare service delivery.
Cole Kennedy, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me.
Thank you for having me.
Cole Kennedy is a PhD student in clinical neuropsychology at the University of Victoria. His work lies at the intersection of brain injury, mental health, and addictions. We were speaking about new research he led into improving health services for people with brain injuries, experiencing homelessness, and mental health and substance use disorders. That's it for the show today. You've been listening to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. Thank you so much for tuning in. I hope you can join me again next week.
People First Radio is a community media project of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society and produced in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed do not necessarily represent the views of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society or its broadcast partners.